It's the 12th of February. 12th of February, and we have an exam coming up next Tuesday. Chapters 1, Introduction, Risk versus Return, Overview of Investment Universe. Make sure you can, that securities handout, we'll take a quick look at it sometime between now and Thursday. Make sure you understand the major asset categories. Just one or two or three sentences, that's all you need. And then Chapter 4. We started Chapter 4, Mutual Funds, last Thursday. We're going to continue with that. We're going to hammer you at the share classes. We'll finish up with that. And then the mutual fund types today. Oh, my goodness. There's so many types that we're only going to look at the major classes of mutual fund types. Okay? But first, we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? Yes. What do you get when you cross a rhetorical question and a joke? Double entendre that doesn't ask anything? I don't know. What?
That's the joke.
That's the joke. Because it's a rhetorical question. What if there were no rhetorical questions? That's actually not bad. Did you hear about the double entendre? Speaking of jokes, did you hear about the double entendre that walked into a bar and ordered a daiquiri? And the bartender gave him one. It's a double entendre. That's what jokes are, double entendres. That's a very obscure joke. Forget that one. Okay, not bad, Kathleen, not bad. What are you getting? That's the joke, okay. I don't know. Anyway, so how are we doing? Not bad, except for Canopy. Where is he? Who told us to buy? Any marijuana stock is going to be just incredibly volatile. But other than that, you guys are awesome. Who decided to go with the bankrupt PG&E? Who was that idea? Nobody wants to take credit for that one? But a pretty good Boeing. I think I told you. Boeing and Airbus now. If you order a plane now, we'll get it to you in 8, 9, 10 years. That's how backlogged they are. That's how far back, how far you in advance you have to order planes. Because air traffic is growing at a phenomenal rate around the world. Why? Because people are making more money around the world, and when they enter the middle class, they want the same things that we take for granted. Vamos a Cancun. Okay. Anyone want to sell anything? Look, saw all these winners. You want to sell your winners? No, hang on to your winners. Sell your losers. Okay, let's continue where we were. Okay, to review. Real quick. Da, 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 da. Let me see if I can get this to work. I'm not always document camera. Ha-ha! Okay. When you get involved with investing, you're going to get on various email lists and U.S. mail lists, and these things are going to start coming in the mail like crazy. And so they just realize that whenever they're trying to get you to come for a steak. Can you see that? Zoom in on that. They're trying to get you to come for a steak. Here. Be our guest for a complimentary gourmet meal at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. Who could say that fast? And then they want you to sign up for peace of mind. This is an insurance, come on. And this one is Red Lobster, but they show a steak. Figure that one. Oh, they do show a lobster. And what is this one? Exclusive dinner. These are people who were stupid enough to buy a timeshare, and they realize that if they think if you're stupid enough to buy a timeshare, we're going to help you get rid of it. But we're going to sell you another one, right? Because permanently eliminate all your timeshare obligations. So if you were uninformed enough to buy a timeshare, and then this one is actually for registered representative insurance agents. This is because I'm on their mailing list. They know I'm a registered representative and insurance agent. So this one is Eddie V's. Whatever. I don't know. Anybody know anything about Eddie V's?
Sure.
Is it a good steakhouse? Seafood? Okay, well, whatever. They're going to give us a free dinner, you and your adult guest. 40 people of our events, and this is a company that will help you market. They will get you leads. And obviously, if you're a registered representative, stockbroker, insurance agent, mortgage broker, whatever, that's a valuable thing to have, you know, get your leads. But you know, whenever you see these things, just realize that, okay, you know it's a come on. But what they do, what the psychology behind it is, if they give you something and something that you think is quite, you know, useful or nice, a dinner, you're more likely to sign up. And they love seniors. They go after seniors like crazy. Ever been to Puerto Vallarta? On many of the shops, it'll say, no timeshare, because you're going to be hit by lots of people trying to get you to go to a timeshare presentation. They'll drive you there, they'll feed you, and they won't let you go. You guys say, well, I want to leave now. No, sorry, the car's not ready yet. We'll keep talking, and we'll sign you up. Got your ABCDs? Let's go. All right, so let's get started. And by the way, if any of you want to go, you can say you're me. They won't know. Okay. Just don't forge my signature on the promissory note. Okay, so we went through the major share classes, the A shares, the B shares, the C shares, the F and I shares, and I'm going to ask you on the exam. So make sure you understand these things. Study this guy. But then we went through, we didn't get to the money pitch yet. Whoops. We went through the various fees and the like, and we saw that the A shares, if you hold it for the long term, are going to wind up being cheaper than any of the other class shares if you believe you need a financial advisor, or if that's the fund you want and you have to have a financial advisor, get your license and be your own financial advisor. We see that the A shares almost always cost less than the B, C, F, I, Z, R, X. And then the index funds, which we'll discuss in detail later on, are almost always going to be cheaper. They better be cheaper. If they're not, it's because some jerk is trying to sneak high-fee index funds into your 401k, your 403b. Now, we did not discuss the breakpoint sales charge. We said that the A shares are assessing a front-end charge. But what you'll see on these things, it'll say maximum charge of 4.25%, or in this case, this is the new economy fund, 5.75%. But that's only if you invest anywhere from between zero and 25,000. Once your account gets above that, or you invest more, you purchase more, now the sales charge goes down to 5%. You see? 100,000, I'm sorry, 50,000, 4.5, 100,000, 3.5, 2.5, 1.5, until finally when your account becomes $1 million or you invest over $1 million, you don't pay any sales charge. Now, what do you think the industry is saying to you or to the public? We want the rich people, right? And that's exactly what they're saying. They know that they make more money off of wealthy investors. If you go to a Merrill Stench or a Mortgage Stupid, I'm sorry, Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley, and say you want to invest $50 a month, they'll look at you and get out of here. You know, they used to say, we only take somebody with at least $50,000. It was $100,000. And now you see this guy Fisher. He wants you, unless you have $500,000, well, no, we don't even want you. I was talking to one of my clients who said she was talking to a broker who said the same thing. I only take people with at least $500,000, and now I'm going to raise that to $750,000. And I just think, well, I guess so. You know, you screw them. If you're going to screw people, you might as well screw people with a lot of money. And so here's something I learned from taking one of the continuing education exams that you have to take from time to time when you're an insurance agent or a broker or whatever. Some brokers, as the individual would start to get to the higher sales charge breakpoint levels, would say, oh, let's go invest over here. Let's change your investment now. We're going to diversify. And you see what they're doing? They would start all over again with a different investment at the higher sales charge. Now, who would do that to their clients? Well, some brokers did. Now if you do that, you can get fined and you can lose your license, and all kinds of bad things will happen to you. But you see what's going on? These are the kind of people you're going to run into when you go into the business, which is why if you have ethics in the business, you're going to get ahead, folks. You're really going to do well. Because there's some people with no ethics whatsoever. And then, oops, come on. Why isn't this working? Hello? Oh, well. Okay, and then we discuss the B shares. The B shares have a contingent deferred sales charge, which if you remember, the first year we're going to charge you 5% or 4% if you take your money out, the back end charge. 2% in the second year, 3% in the second year, 2%, 1%, until after 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, depending on the mutual fund, you pay no back end fee. Are you with me? You understand? This is called, in the insurance world, a surrender charge. And they have these surrender schedules. But they don't start at 4 or 5, 6%. They start at 20%. So you invest in an annuity, and it might take you 20 years before you don't pay any back-end fee. Surrender fee is what they call it. So you're going to study this, right? Nod your head yes, because you make me feel good when that. But more importantly, you're going to be the genius. You're going to be the guru when you're at that 401k meeting and they're throwing all these share classes at you, and you can pick out which ones, because these are just the major categories. There's lots of other different types of share classes you'll see, but they all fit somewhere in here. They all fit somewhere in these kinds of either front end, back end. They get you along the way, or they kill you with a wealth management fee, or they're true no load. So now that you know everything you need to know about share classes, I'm going to give you $10,000 10 years ago. Is that cool? I don't know, the industry uses $10,000. I don't know why. Do you want to have the large cap AB, AllianceBernstein, large cap growth fund, class A, because we know the class A shares are the cheapest over time, the new economy fund, class A? Do you want the Legg Mason Value Trust, now called the Clearbridge Value Trust, which didn't have the A shares? They only had the primary class. Now they're called C. Or do you want to go the abstemious route? Did I tell you about abstemious? Isn't that a great word? Abstemious? It means cheap. You want to go the cheap route or with the index 500 from Vanguard or Fidelity? Which one? A, B, C, D. Got your A, B, C, Ds? Don't worry, it's not real money. Okay. Yeah? Come on, raise them high. Look around. So it's a lot of A's and a lot more D's. Well, how did you do? How did you do? It's working now. The large cap growth fund did a little over 15%. New economy fund, a little over 14%. Legg Mason Value Trust, 10.5%. And the Vanguard Index did 13%. Almost. Now, here's the S&P 500. Why didn't the index fund match the index? Because the index doesn't have any fees. The index is just a list of companies, 500 companies. So there's a little bit of fees that they take out here. So fees are important. Are they important? We want to know how we're being charged. We want to understand how we're being charged. But they don't tell you the whole story. When comparing mutual funds, you must look at many attributes, not the which, in my humble opinion, are the rates of return, preferably over long periods of time. And I don't even like 10 years. I like 20, 30, 50 years. I want to see how well this mutual fund or this mutual fund company, because they might have some funds that I want, but they weren't even around then. I want to see how well they've done over decades. So notice that these two guys actually beat the index. These two actually beat the index. They're actively managed. This guy did much less than the index. And this is what people are going to tell you. They're going to say, nobody can beat the index. There's no actively managed mutual funds that can beat the passively managed index 500. And guess what? They're wrong. They're not correct. They are out there, folks. And your job as a prudent long-term investor is to go find the ones that have done it over decades. Cool? Now, if you had flopped this, you had gone back 10 years, this would have been exactly opposite. This guy would have clobbered the Standard & Poor's 500. Until about 2006, he beat the S&P 500 15 years in a row, calendar years. And it was exactly the opposite. This was like 37,000, and these guys were like 20 and 17, 18. And so
the industry does change. You know, there's no guarantee. It's because, and I like both of these funds. They're both excellent funds, but there's no guarantee that 10 years from now it's not going to be flipped. But funds that have done well over decades tend to continue to do well over decades, unless something changes at the industry. Okay, questions, thoughts, ideas? So study, study, study. Now, where are we? So now it's checking for comprehension, and these are very similar to what you're going to see on the exam. So this is also a way to see what my exams look like. There's true, false, multiple choice questions, and then there's an essay, short answer, calculations. No calculations on the exam next Tuesday. Not yet. Next exam. Oh, yeah. These shares do not have an upfront sales load. Instead, they assess a decreasing back-end load if you withdraw your money within 6 years. The annual operating expense is higher, courtesy of the 12B1 fees, A, B, C, or the FRI. A, B, C. Come on, you don't have to be right. Don't worry about it. Right, these are the B shares. You hear back-end load, that's the B shares. And then they revert to A shares after 6 or 8, and you get the lower annual operating expense. Oh, this isn't working well. Something's wrong. Okay. These shares do not have an upfront fee and only a 1% back-end fee if redeemed within 1 year. The advisor called them no load, which you're not supposed to do anymore, but you notice that the annual operating expense is higher than other share classes. Again, courtesy of the ubiquitous. Like that word, ubiquitous? It means for every always around there. Yeah, universal. A, B, C, yes, they're the lots of C's. Good job. They sometimes revert to A or F shares after 10 years or so. And your financial advisor tells you that these shares have no sales fee and a very low annual operating expense. She mumbles something about wealth management. These are A, B, C, or FRI shares. Right, these are the FFI shares. She also did her best not to explain to you that her brokerage firm is going to charge you an extra 2% every year. And by the way, as we said, there are dozens of other share classes depending upon the mutual fund company, but they all are variations on these themes that we've learned about. Cool? Okay. Now, we're going to get your thinking toque on. How we got room for room? There's some over in the corner here, and this guy, and only one will sit there. Sit up the corner. Because you are going to be bombarded today with various fund types. Oh, by the way, I'm sorry, one thing I didn't say. You see all the different share classes? The mutual fund is the same. The mutual fund is investing in the exact same investments. It's not a different mutual fund. It's the same mutual fund. The managers are the same. They have the same underlying investments. It's the only difference is how you're being charged. I think I said that on Tuesday, but on Thursday, but I don't remember if I did or not. If I didn't, I apologize. Questions, thoughts? Cool. Oh, and did I show you? I don't think I showed you this guy yet. Let's see if I can show you this. Let's go. Did I show you the prospectus? Did I show you the prospectus? Not yet. Okay, this is the document that outlines not only the fees, but also the objectives and who the manager is and the like. And nobody reads them. That needs to be a little focused. Let's see if we got autofocus. Focus. Is that good? Cool. This is the document. Now, notice, A shares, C shares. They got rid of the B shares. Let's see if we can zoom in a little bit more. Then the T shares, what are those? But again, they're similar to the others. And then there's the F shares. So notice there's the upfront fee for the A shares. Can you see that? I need to zoom in a little bit more. It's what we already looked at. Focus. Luke. So there's the upfront fee for the A shares, the 1% back-end fee if you take it within a year. You can't see that. I can, but you can't. And then here are all the various fee classes. And when they, in the 403B meeting, 401K meeting, they're going to hand these things out, maybe not even, and people are going to look at it and just not even bother. But you see, this is what you are going to understand. So I recommend it. On the website, there are lots of links to various mutual fund companies, and I want you to download their
annual reports as part of your assignment and download the prospectuses and take a look at them and see if you can figure them out. But they're very useful. Did I tell you why they're so useful? If you have insomnia at night, what you do is you start reading the annual report, you start reading the prospectus, and I guarantee that you will be fast asleep very quickly. You will not make it to the end. Is that a deal? See, you don't have to take the drugs. You just start reading annual prospectus. Okay. Now, in your packet, on the second page, is what I call the mutual fund scramble sheet. And we're going to build this on the board here. And we used to have more board and less screen. So the screen's bigger, which is impressive, but now we have less board. So we're going to build this. And these are the major types that we want you to know. There are dozens of others. Subcategories. And so it's very confusing, but we want you to study these and realize that all the others are, again, just more and more refinements, more and more subcategories of what we're going to take a look at today. Cool? Anybody need one? Okay. Here we go. So now we're going to go from, how are we doing over time? Not bad. We've got to get through this today. I apologize. And then on Thursday, we'll then take a look at various companies, zero in on one particular mutual fund, and we should finish up the chapter on Thursday. If not, then we'll, you know, push it further another day. I'm more interested in relearning everything, but we should get it through. So first, we're going to go from the most riskiest mutual funds to the least riskiest. Risk versus return. And so stocks are by far the most riskiest that we'll talk about. There are now exotic mutual funds that do things that are far riskier than stocks, but we don't even want to go there. We don't have, first of all, time, plus I don't want you to invest in them. You go right ahead if you want. The most aggressive type that we'll look at are called aggressive growth funds. Aggressive growth funds. These are funds that are looking for eye-popping returns. They have huge turnovers because they're buying and selling. Basically, folks, they are rolling the dice. And they might rent a stock. They don't own a stock for 3 months, 6 months. Their turnover might be 200%, 288%. In my humble opinion, again, you're going to hear different opinions, I don't think this is investing. You know, it's gambling. It's speculating. Don't use that word, gambling. It's speculating. There are mutual funds that we said that are even more aggressive than these. You might see mutual funds that are called Ultra or, what's the one? Power Shares or some strange name. Power Shares or something like that. These are even worse. You may do very, very well. You may do very poorly. Now, this analogy, if it doesn't work for you, just ignore it. But I love food, so I like to think of food while I'm working. Right? And so when you go to a buffet, you get your plate. Do you load it up with jalapeno peppers? Do you load it up with the most spiciest food on the plate? Now, maybe some of you do, right? But no, you have a little bit. So if this analogy makes any sense, great. And if not, the most riskiest we can think of as the spice. This is the spice. You put a little bit on your plate, right? Don't load up your plate with the spice because it's hot. Right? You can get burned, and you might do very, very well, but more likely what's going to happen when the market turns down, you're going to panic and run for the exit, and that's because investing is simple, but it ain't easy. You have to live through a downturn and see how you're going to react. Cool? Now, the next category are growth funds. And these invest in companies typically that are growing their earnings, growing the company. And we'll discuss stocks as one of the problems with having mutual funds before stocks, but there are stocks that are often called growth stocks. So these mutual funds will invest primarily in high growth companies. So some fund companies now have a category or two more speculative than aggressive growth, ultra momentum funds. Janus 20 is a real good example of this. I mentioned Janus 20 last week. Janus is the name of the company. They're based in Denver. And they had a mutual fund, I think they still have it, that was very popular during the internet bubble 20 years ago, that only invests in 20 companies. Remember, to be a mutual fund, you cannot put more than 5% of your investment into any one security, and any one investment. You cannot put more than 5% of your money into any one investment, which means you have to have at least 20, right? Because 5 divided into 100 would be 20. So they're saying, we're going to go with 20 stocks. Now, is this why we invest in mutual funds? Why do we invest in mutual funds? Two wonderful reasons. Everyone should say diversification and professional money management. Wait until I ask you, why do we invest in mutual funds? Yeah, you got to know that, folks. You got to be talk. You think I might be thinking I'm crazy, but you're maybe right. But when you talk, you actually learn better. Yes. Well, Janus is two-faced. Well, that's the god of that was the god at the Roman. Yeah. So that's not mine. You may do well, folks. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say you shouldn't do this, but it's not what I call investing. Here's where it starts to get a little weird, and that's why you see that the presentation is boom, boom, boom. But on the handout, and you try doing this. This is not that easy. I've been practicing for a while. Capital appreciation. A capital appreciation fund is often lumped in with aggressive growth and growth funds. But they're a little different, right? They're mutual funds that seek growth of capital. How's that different from a growth fund? Well, in the prospectus of a growth fund, it'll say we will seek to be primarily invested in growth stocks. At least 80% of our portfolio will be growth stocks. That's the growth fund. Whereas a capital appreciation fund will be more flexible. They will invest pretty much anywhere they find there's an opportunity to grow the capital. Yes. Normally, yes. IPOs are, hopefully, you hope they're growing, right? What's an IPO? Initial public offering. But really what it means is imaginary profits only. Okay? Or it's probably overpriced. Or insider's profit opportunities. And we'll discuss IPOs later on. For the vast majority of us investors, IPOs are not a good deal. It doesn't mean you're not going to come across one like a Google, like a Farcebook that'll do well. Typically, IPOs, when they go public, within 1 year, they're down 50%. At least, and that happened to Facebook. It came out, promptly dropped 50% because it's probably overpriced. It was overpriced. And then it turned around and did really, really well. So. Capital appreciation funds, and I like to think of these as painting with a broad brush. They're not laser focused on just growth funds. They're more flexible. They might invest in companies that are not typically growth stocks. They're labeled something else. In general, they tend to be as risky as growth and aggressive growth funds, but not always. That's why they're lumped together. But they're different. And you see what you're up against? One of the most famous capital appreciation funds was the Fidelity Magellan Fund. Yeah? Sorry. That's okay. It's okay.
So as far as the terminology goes, I'm having trouble differentiating growth and appreciation.
Yeah, as well, it's very subtle, isn't it? It's a very subtle difference. A growth mutual fund will typically invest in companies that are growing, their earnings, the ones that are on the cover of GQ and Vanity Unfair. The hot stocks, right, the hot stocks. Whereas,
sexy stocks, right? The ones that have the $200 haircut and the pecs and the teeth. And then what a capital appreciation fund might say, oh, no, I don't understand. I want to invest in Dunkin' Donuts, you know, because for some reason they're doing really, really well. And that's exactly what, that was one of his, Fidelity Magellan, Peter Lynch. We'll take a look at, in fact, I recommended his book. I'll show it to you again. One up on Wall Street. That was one of his biggest winners was Dunkin' Donuts, which, is that a growth company? You know, no. So, and to show you how difficult, you're right, Efren, it's not easy. It's very subtle. One of the biggest capital appreciation funds is called the Growth Fund of America. It's been around since 1973. It's a capital appreciation fund, though. And they, you go to the company and say, well, how come you call yourself the Growth Fund of America? And they say, look, we've been around before this name was invented, okay? Capital appreciation funds weren't even called capital appreciation funds when we started. So, on you. We predate them. So we're not changing our name.
So if growth refers to stocks that are on the up and up, what is appreciation?
In other words, all we want to do is raise, we just want to raise money. Even if we have to buy a company that's a stodgy old railroad company that's been around for 180 years or whatever, if we think there's value there and there's a possibility for the company to be worth more, to gain value, we're going to invest in that. Do you see the subtle difference? Yeah. It is subtle. I apologize.
So you could say like ultra and aggressive and growth funds are capital appreciation? But just because it's capital appreciation doesn't necessarily mean it's ultra.
Right, exactly. In other words, if you just look at the two words, capital appreciation, that means I want to grow the money. And obviously, all of these want to grow the money. But a capital appreciation fund typically is a fund that has a more broader mandate than just investing in growth funds. See what you're up against? But just realize that they're all thrown in together. And that's why I tried to write it that way. Cool? Okay, yeah.
What we're talking about here is investment strategies that mutual funds use.
That's exactly what we're talking about. We are talking about how are you going to invest my money, this strategy. What is the strategy of this mutual fund? Is that a good answer? Yeah? Okay, good. So now we're going down to the next category, and that's, okay, let's change the slide. Boom, boom, boom. Growth and income. Oh, this is my favorite. Growth and income. When we discuss stocks, you'll hear people say growth and income, which means, yes, we want the stock to go up. We're looking for capital appreciation. We're looking for the value of the company to go up. But we also want dividends because income from stocks is dividends. And some stocks pay very, very, well, healthy dividends. So wouldn't it be nice if they called it a growth and dividends fund? They're not going to do that. They're called growth and income funds. And where is this on our buffet? This is the pasta. This is the meat, right? This is the main entree, right? This is this is what you put most of your plate on, okay? This is what you want to. And why is that? Because over the long period of time, as we'll see when we get to chapter 5, stock returns are not just the value of the stock going up. They're also dividends. Specifically reinvested dividends, taking those dividends and putting them back into your investment. So this is personally my favorite. And if somebody were to ask you on an exam, for example, what would you recommend or what would you invest in? And you said, oh, I like growth and income stock funds. Oh, boy, wouldn't that professor be very, very happy. In fact, this is what I recommend to most people just starting out. Because they're going to go down. Don't get me wrong. If the stock market crashes, they're going to go down. We're going to see that on Thursday. But nowhere near as much as these guys. They're nowhere near as risky. They're nowhere near as volatile. And then there are two other categories that are often lumped in here. And that is, where's my purple? Value. And sometimes called blend. And then every once in a while you hear people use the term core. But you have to be careful Because value is a term that we throw out in the investment world that can mean different things to different people. Payana, why do you give me all these vagaries? Because they're there. And we'll look more and more at value. What do we mean by value, or what do some people mean by value, when we get to Chapter 5, when we talk about stocks in detail. Value funds, the typical value fund, seek stocks that are undervalued in the market by investing in shares that have low PE multiples and high dividend. Wait, out of favor companies. Companies that all of a sudden, oh, nobody would touch that. They're on sale, right? Again, some people say, oh, that's toxic. Stay away from them. Other people say, no, look at this. This is on sale. You ever hear of GE? General Electric? They have been clobbered the last couple of years. And so value investors, value funds, would look at GE and say, well, maybe there's a good reason to invest in this company. It's out of favor. It's a value fund. But be careful, because we're going to come back to this idea of value. Cool? And now the last category is equity income, which is a dumb name. I didn't make it up. It wasn't my idea. Because what does equity mean?
Ownership.
And what do we also call stocks? Everyone should say equities. Wait till I ask you. We also call stocks?
Equity.
And you have to answer me. I know it sounds ridiculous, but you learn better if you answer me. Well, another name for stocks is? So wouldn't it be nice if they used the word stock? They don't. And what is income from stocks? Everyone should say dividends. Wait till I ask you. What is our income from stocks? So wouldn't it be nice if they called them stock dividend funds? They don't. They call them equity income funds. That way they can say, you see how important we are to you? Because we're your financial advisor. We know what equity income means. Now, these are mutual funds that typically will invest in very boring companies. Companies that are not growing very quickly, but are producing dividends. You ever hear of railroads? Are railroads going anywhere? And you got about as boring as you can be. Food companies, utilities, real estate investment trusts. We'll look at those later on. They're not growing very fast, but they are throwing off dividends to their investors. And they may invest in bonds to generate the income when the investment advisor believes that stock prices have risen to levels that threaten preservation of capital. So these guys, they're stock funds. Don't get me wrong. They're going to go down when the market goes down. But if they're well run, if they actually stick to their knitting, if they do what they say they're going to do, they're going to go down far less than these guys. Far less. Now, what are these on the buffet? What would you call these? Oatmeal. You got it. That's exactly what I like to think of them as. Is oatmeal exciting? That's not what you use the word disgusting. But is it good for you? Yeah, it is. Look what it does for horses. Horses are beautiful animals, and they eat oats, right? So this is the boring stuff, you know. What? Slow growers, if they're growing at all, right? Yeah, and so there you go. Cool. Now, what happened in the 2000 to 2002 bear market? The emphasis had been on these fast-growing internet stocks, technology, and they were bid up to nosebleed prices. And some of the companies that were in this category, railroads, foods, their prices actually went down. They were called old economy, as opposed to new economy, the new economy fund. And they actually did well in 2000 to 2002. Some of them went up. Well, because why? Because people who had got suckered into the high valuation aggressive growth type companies realized that, hey, a railroad company ain't going to disappear overnight like an internet startup. You ever hear of pets.com? Pets.com? I see it's because it's gone. It was the sock. You remember the sock? Nobody remembers that? Okay. E-toys. Yeah, e-toys, they're gone. And, yeah, okay. All right, so anyway, cool. So those are the main categories of stocks in terms of what kind of companies they buy. Now, we're going to overlay other categories on top of that to make it a little bit more tricky and a little bit more exciting. The first category is the capitalization, which is a fancy word for how big is the company. Capitalization. And that's why you see large cap. Oops, large. Large cap. Mid cap. Small cap. And we'll do some calculations in Chapter 5 when we get to stocks. But basically we're saying, how much is the company worth, right? And you can real quick think of them as the biggie, the papa bears, the mama bears, and the baby bears. Now, which of these do you think is the riskiest? There's a couple seats over there. Which is the riskiest? Right. Small cap's going to be the riskiest, because small companies just don't have the same resources. They get clobbered by certain things. What's the least riskiest? Large cap. Everyone say large cap. Wait till I ask you. What's the least riskiest? And obviously mid cap is somewhere in between. When the economy goes into recession, small companies get hammered. Large companies have the resources to weather the storm. When the economy grows out of a recession, what happens with small companies? They skyrocket. They do really well. Well, first of all, they got beaten down harder. Plus, they're more nimble. They can better adjust to changing conditions. Make sense? Yeah? We'll discuss this in more detail again when we get to stocks. And then, so large cap, mid cap, small cap. And then we're going to also overlay on top of this the domesticity, which is a fancy word where is the company based? And we discussed this last week, or a week before. There are three categories: domestic, global, and international, also called foreign, also called overseas. What's the difference between global and international, everyone? International is outside the U.S. Say that again, I can't hear you.
Like international, that means like they're still...
No, that means they're outside the United States.
Yeah. Global includes
U.S. Global includes the U.S. Everyone should see, because this is what you're studying, right? You're going back and looking over the notes, and you're making sure you're studying this. Global means todo el mundo, right? Everybody, including the U.S. International is outside the U.S. And, of course, domestic is based in the U.S. And traditionally, who was the riskiest? Everyone should say international. And I know you're still awake, you know, because I was a math major, and we used to fall asleep with our eyes open. So I want to make sure you're still awake. Which was the riskiest? The least riskiest was? And global was somewhere in between. Is that true anymore?
No.
Not necessarily. The world is global, and so it's still true to some extent, but not as it used to be. So you have these three columns, and it's like Chinese food. Pick one from column A. You don't see that too much on the West Coast. The East Coast, you see that. Pick one from column A and one from column B and column C. So now, can you see kind of where we got 11,000 mutual funds? Because once one company has... Now, where's my... who's got the scramble sheet? Do you have the packet from last week?
Yeah.
Okay, pull it out because we're on the scramble sheet, page number 2. A company, once one company has a global large cap growth fund, okay, so once one company says, we have a global large cap growth fund, and all the other companies have to have a global large cap growth fund, or it's a, domestic small cap aggressive growth. So ha, we have now, wrong, let's get a different color, a domestic small cap aggressive growth. Was it aggressive growth?
Yeah,
okay, aggressive growth. You see? That's why I call it the scramble sheet. And so you, as a potential investor, have to navigate these terms and these types of different mutual funds. And then realize that they're going to break it up into even more categories. Cool? Thoughts? Ideas? Comments? Criticisms? Suggestions? No? You feel overwhelmed? Yeah.
The large cap, mid cap, and small cap is based on their...
size.
What is called that? The market...
Capitalization.
Market cap, right?
Market cap. You can say market cap. The size.
Large cap is...
Home Depot, Coca-Cola...
That's right. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to that in chapter 5. Yeah, 10 billion. 10 billion is considered the category, the cutoff for large companies. But now you hear people saying, oh, no, it's 15 billion. And it used to be that, you know, a few billion was a large company. It changes over time as companies get larger. We've had the first trillion-dollar company. That's Apple. Not $1 trillion, any worth anymore. But, yes. And then mid-cap is anywhere between 2 and 3 up to 10. Or now you're hearing people say 4, 5, 6 up to 15. And then small-cap is below that. We're going to do the market capitalization calculations when we get to chapter 5. So they're not hard to do. And, in fact, you don't have to do them. You just look it up. You go on the Internet or you go to the library. You've heard of libraries, right? And you look up what this company is worth. Cool? Good, good, good. All right, so now, there are a few other categories that we're going to throw into the mix. Regional mutual funds that invest just in Japan or Canada or the Nordic companies or the Far East or Latin America. Emerging markets, India, Mexico, Brazil, Russia, Philippines, China, etc. So, is this a good idea from an investment standpoint? Well, it's up to you. But as far as I'm concerned, I buy mutual funds for diversification. Does it make sense to just invest in Japan or the Far East or Latin America? Maybe. But again, think of it as the spice. It's a little bit of spice. You just came back from the Far East. You see what's going on. You came back from India. You see, oh my goodness, what's going on. So put a little bit of India or a little bit of Peru into your mix. But don't bet the farm, in my humble opinion. You may do very, very well. God, I hope you do. I hope you do. And you may do very, very poorly. And we like to avoid large losses because they are... first of all, emotionally, it feels horrible, right? And then you have to have the steel. You have to have the wherewithal to hold on and not sell at the bottom. If you believe that the future looks bright. There's going to be times when these... They sometimes they're called submerging markets. Have you ever heard that term? You know, emerging markets? It used to be called the third world. And there's a cute little story about this. Back in the 1980s, the World Bank, which was part of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, wanted to create a mutual fund, but not for retail investors. This was for institutional investors, people who are supposed to know better. That was based on the third world. They wanted to call it the third world market something or other, third world mutual fund. And they gave a presentation in New York. The investment managers were not too excited about it. And one of them said, young man, I guess because this guy was old, there's no way I'm going to invest my money at this point in your endeavor. But for God's sakes, don't call it the third world fund. And they went, okay, so that's when the term emerging markets started. You started to see emerging, developing markets, don't call it the third world fund. This is before the Soviet Union fell apart.
Sounds like mutual funds would do anything to try to get people confident in the economy.
Say it louder, Efren.
Well, it's a bit disarming because we're here getting an
Well, I wouldn't use that. I wouldn't say it's that high, but you're right. Mutual funds are computing for your dollars, and some of them are very ethical, and some of them are not so ethical.
They can basically use media, like world media, or you know, like political climate in these regions to sell stocks to people.
Well, obviously, there's an old saying: invest when there's blood in the streets.
Yeah.
Now's the time to go invest in Venezuela, folks. Oh my gosh! Right. Well, that's an old saying. It comes from
And there's a fund for that.
And we have a fund for that, right? And it's going to go down 80% in the next 20 days. So wait 20 days and then invest. But no, but you see, that's for the more speculative-minded people, and you might do well. I wish you a lot of success.
It's like reading the door during the
Well, that's a little different. That's not legal.
That,
this, this, No, I don't know, Efren. We're going to go have our cynical award to go to Efren. Okay. And then some people, you know, it's capitalism. What are you going to do? It's not perfect. And then sector funds. These are funds just in, we'll see some on Thursday. These are funds that just invest in a sector of the economy, wireless communications, or leisure and travel, or, you know, software. And it breaks software up into a few different subcategories. Again, to my mind, I want a mutual fund that's diversified. But if you're in the healthcare field and you see what's going on, you see, oh my goodness, the thing is darn exploding, then sure, a little bit of your portfolio go with a healthcare fund or maybe, you know, an energy fund. You work in the energy field or whatever. And then if anybody tries to sell you a market timing, just say no thanks. Because we'll discuss market timing. These are people who say, if you look at our system, you will see that we would have gotten out right before the crash of 1987, and we would have gotten out right before the crash of 2000 and 2008. And what they did is they backdated it. They made the model work in reverse. And they say, it's going to work in the future. You know. And sometimes they actually believe it. They actually, most of the time, they're just trying to fool you, I think. But some of you get the feeling that some of these people actually believe that they're going to do well in the future. Good luck. So now, the next category are bond funds. And what are bonds? If somebody were to ask you, what are bonds? In one or two or three sentences, what would you say? Everyone should say loans. Everyone say they're loans that are from corporations, corporate bonds, municipal bonds. Treasury, they pay interest and they promise to repay the principal. Debt. They are debt financing. They are debt, as opposed to equities. And again, we're going to do this exact same thing. We're going to see the from the riskiest to the least riskiest. And the riskiest bond funds are called junk bonds. Junk bonds. Well, we don't like that term junk. They're high yield. Doesn't that sound better? High-yield bond funds. These are bonds that are in trouble. These are bonds that are paying high interest rates. Why? For the same reason that if you have a really bad credit score, you're going to pay higher interest rates, right? Because the banks and the credit unions, they don't want to touch you unless you say, okay, you know, instead of, you know, what are anybody going looking for a car these days? Are they for like 4% or so, 3-4% for loans?
That's the problem if you have a pulse.
Exactly. If you then go to a dealership and they look at your we'll give you a loan at 11% or 12% and some even more. So the same thing is true here. Now, you may get your money. You know, they may do very well. Some bond funds have done well. But what happens is when the stock market falls, these guys follow the stock market. Huh? They tend to be tied mostly to corporations because the Treasury and most municipalities don't issue junk. They don't issue high-yield bonds because they have good credit scores. Southwestern is A-minus. So we'll talk about what that means. Whereas companies do. Companies sometimes are in trouble. They need money. We've got to get from point A to point B, but we're going to have to pay a lot for it. And if the economy goes into recession, the stock market dies, these guys are going to dive with it. And so you will see that. We'll see that they're more correlated with stocks. Then the next category is corporate bond funds. And these are bonds that are tied to corporations. Corporations are going to have to pay more than municipalities and the Treasury. Why? Because they just don't have the same credit worthiness. Plus, there's a couple of tax-related reasons why that's true. There are some bonds that are bond funds that invest in what are called convertible bonds. These are some of those hybrid investments that we'll come back to way later on after we get through stocks and bonds. And, you know, it sounds exciting. Doesn't it sound exciting to have a convertible? You know, wind blowing through your... No, they don't usually do very well. And then next category, muni bonds. Sometimes you just hear them say munis. Municipal bonds, some are insured. We'll see why later on. in terms of when we do the calculations, these are very popular with high net worth individuals. The income is free from federal taxes. Why? The feds can't tax the states and local governments. The local governments and the feds and the states can't tax the feds. So these become very popular once you've gone into the high net worth, high income. And then if you buy one from your state, in fact, you know, our state would be California, you do not pay federal taxes, nor do you pay state income taxes. Why? Because the state says, look, we want you to invest with us, right? We want you to invest in your home state. If you do, we will waive, not this waive, we will forego the income tax. So when Southwestern sold all these bonds, made all these loans for the stadium and the new math and the fitness center, one of the governing board members, I didn't say I was going to keep my mouth shut, but he was saying, we need to let the people in the South Bay know about these bonds so they can invest in Southwestern College. Maybe a few folks in Bonita. Yeah, but no. People in Chula and San Isidro National City. Coronado. You believe it that Coronado is in our district? Yeah. Coronado is part of Southwestern Community College District. How many folks from Coronado do you think come to Southwestern for their education? Is there one? Maybe a few. There's maybe a few, but no.
Oh, the guy with the
Ferrari. Mm. And with the armed guard in front of it. There he is. I saw him. Okay. And then the least riskiest of all, and that's the U.S.-backed bond. Now, there are two flavors, and we'll discuss the subtleties before later on when we get to bonds. But there are entities that are backed by the U.S. government. Well, not really. Well, yes, they are. Have you ever heard of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae? And they're not candy companies. They're not burger companies. These are companies that were spun off, sponsored by the United States Congress. But they were private entities. And for decades, the Congress people would say, no, they are private entities. If they get into trouble, the United States is not backing them up. But it was always implied, it was always tacit, it was always unspoken that, yeah, if they get in trouble, the government's going to come to the rescue. And guess what happened? In the Great Recession, they got in trouble, and what happened? The government came to the rescue, and now you and I are proud owners of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And that doesn't mean they're not making money. They are. They make a lot of money. They fulfill a very important task, and that's providing for home loans. They're providing for home loans, but there's a problem. And eventually, somehow, we got to get the government out of the mortgage business. I'm not sure how it's going to happen. Everybody has their own idea. But they indeed were. Yeah. The government came to the rescue. And then the actual treasury bonds that are backed by the United States Treasury in the full faith and credit, you'll hear them called treasury funds or government security funds. And because the states can't tax the feds, and the feds can't tax the states, they are free from state and local taxes. So the government will charge you income tax on your interest from their bonds, but the state of California will not. On your tax return, you'll say, oh, you know, this is interest that came from the federal government, and the California says, okay, we can't do that. Cool? So from the riskiest to the least riskiest. Yeah.
Question.
Sure. I love questions, especially easy ones.
So does that, since the automakers like Ford and GM and all them were bailed out?
Wait a minute. We got to talk about the difference. Were they really bailed out? What happened, not Ford, but GM and Chrysler Ford did too, but they didn't accept it. You remember? They went to the Congress and said, we're sorry. Can you help us out? But they flew in their private jets. Ooh, stupid. Of course, the news media had a field day. So the next time, they went by bus. And what did the government do? The Congress allocated money to be paid in case they failed. So these were government-backed, but not the government didn't write the check. Banks wrote the checks. And if Ford, Chrysler, or GM failed, then the taxpayer would make the banks and other investors whole. So they were backed by they were backstopped, if you will. They were guaranteed, that's the word, guaranteed by the federal government, but they actually didn't do that. Now, this is a question. Is that it? Did I answer your question?
Yes, yeah, so I was wondering if that would be the same thing with, like, what happened with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
No, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were subsumed. They were brought into what's called receivership.
Well, that's what I was thinking. If the federal government, then if they did have to bail them out, would it be?
No, if it, see, that's the thing. You can't go back and do it again and see what would happen if they had failed. If the car companies had failed, it would be a very different economy. It would be a very different world because so many people depend on cars. So we can't really go back and see that. And there are some people say, yes, we should have let them fail. The jerks, they've gotten their own problem. This is capitalism. And other people say, no, you don't understand. This is a huge part of our economy. If you let them fail, you're going to have a big mess on your hands. And so you can't, there's no do-over. There's no $2 trillion, $18 trillion economies to do the, let's let them fail and let's not let them fail. It doesn't work that way.
I was going to ask if the U.S. agrees to do something like that, do they get anything in return? Do they get to implement their own higher standards?
Are you talking about the U.S. back ones? Fannie and Freddie? We can set terms, yeah. Yeah, don't have a party. Yes, Matthew? Yeah, that's the idea. Oh, sometimes more. Sometimes more. And during the junk bond heyday in the 1980s, some of them were paying 17-18%. And oh, yeah! Yeah, much more risk. You understand? The more return potential, the more risk you're going to get. There's no way to get around that.
Are junk bonds also short-term or vague?
No, some can be long-term. Some can be long-term. Okay, and then, okay, what was I going to say? Okay, then what do? We do the exact same thing. We overlay two other categories on it. And this is where it gets a little tricky. I should have left more room, shouldn't I? Long-term, intermediate-term, and then short term. Now, oh boy, this is a little tricky. Which one do you think is the most riskiest? Okay, S, small, S, short, large, L. No, it's exactly the opposite. Long term is the most riskiest. Huh? Short term is the least riskiest. Well, when you think about it, it's counterintuitive, but it actually makes perfect sense. If you're going to lend money to somebody for 6 months, as opposed to 30 years, or 2 years versus 10 years, you see? There's more time for things to go wrong in 30 years than if you lend money for 2 years. And that's why if you go with a 30-year mortgage, you're going to pay more than if you go with a 15-year mortgage. The interest rate will be less. Those of you in the Business 121 class, we'll see that, and we'll see that here also. Short-term bonds, as they get closer and closer to maturity, 2-3 years, they start to look like money markets. They start to look like treasury bills and corporate paper because they're getting closer and closer to their maturity date. Making sense? And then, of course, we got the global and the international and the domestic category. So just as we did with stocks, all right, I can never remember what I did. What did I do? Okay, did domestic, long-term, high yield. So, for you, we have a domestic, long-term, high-yield bond fund. Pick one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. So you see how we can wind up with 11,000 funds? It's not hard. It's just that happens. Because everybody, all the mutual fund companies start competing, and they're competing for your money. They're trying to survive. It's not easy. Okay, so now, the next category. The next category are balanced funds? Wait a minute. Balanced funds are funds, I'm running out of room, I apologize. I did not plan well. Are funds that invest in a mix of stocks and bonds. Now, Piano, shouldn't they be in between stocks and bonds? If you're telling me that stocks are very risky and bonds are much less risky, you add the two together, you get something that's in the middle, right? Wrong. In theory, not always in practice, they should be less risky. Why?
because stocks and bonds are often negatively correlated, which is a fancy way of saying they move in different time frames. When stocks are doing well, it's often because the stock market, the economy is zooming ahead. What happens to interest rates when the economy zooms ahead? They go up. Interest rates going up for bonds, bond prices go down, as we learn later on. And so they tend, but not always. Sometimes they all go down together. They all go up together. Sometimes that happens. So they tend to move in a seesaw fashion. Stocks do well, bonds don't do well. Bonds do well, stocks don't do well. When the economy goes into recession, stocks crater. Interest rates go down. We'll find that when interest rates go down, bond prices go up. So if you invest in a bond fund, you're going to smooth out those bumps along the way in both categories, theoretically. Now, it doesn't always work out that way, as we'll see when we get to 2008. But that's the theory involved, and that's why we put them less risky than bonds or stocks. Yeah?
Okay, so that book that talks about stocks for the long run, in the first chapter was explaining the relation between interest rates and inflation rates. So how do bonds affect that? Bonds.
Well, we'll get into more detail when we get to bonds. But yeah, bond holders hate inflation because you're getting paid back with dollars that are worth less. So bond holders hate inflation. So that's why they'll demand higher interest rates when inflation goes up. And also the Fed. Wait till the next chapter. See, that's the problem with doing mutual funds. You're going to see that sometimes when inflation is out of control, the Federal Reserve Board will start ratcheting up short-term interest rates. They'll try to break the back of inflation. Right. When they do that, they often cause the economy to go into recession. And in fact, we had horrible recessions in 1980 and 1982.
Yeah, that's what I said, because as the interest rates raise, people are less likely to borrow money. And then when the interest rates are lower, they're more likely to borrow money.
Exactly. Supply and demand. Yeah. Where are our economists? Supply and demand.
But McGraw-Hill book is actually really easy to read.
Stocks for the long run. Oh, he's a phenomenal writer. Yeah. His name is Schiller. No, that's the other guy. It's the other guy. Oh, I can't remember his name. What's his name? Oh, Poochie. See, Robert Schiller is his buddy, and he's the bear. And Jeremy Siegel. Jeremy Siegel is the professor. He's very sharp. Yeah, it's a good book. Not as good as The Intelligent Investor. Okay, now. All right, so now. What you have to... Okay, they'll normally do about 60-40, and we'll say why that's a good allocation. But this is a tremendous choice for people who are really terrified of the stock market. If you have somebody, or you're one of them, who's just really, really scared, you say, look, let's go with a balance fund. You know, you'll have some bonds, and you'll have some stocks. And I love this one. This is one of the nation's oldest balance funds, called the American Balance Fund. How's that for a generic name? And they state in their prospectus that this fund is managed as the complete U.S. investment program of a prudent investor. We will never have more than 75% stocks and less than 25% bonds, and we will never have less than 50% stocks and more than 50% bonds. So they will stay balanced. You see? You understand? Yes?
Russell Group does that.
Russell, I'm sure, yeah, lots of people have that same kind of idea that we'll stay balanced. Now, be careful, because there's another category that is often lumped in with the balance funds called asset allocation. And these funds are more tactical, if you will. They are going to try to be more aggressive. They might say, oh, it's time to put 100% in stocks. Forget bonds. Or no, it's time to move everything out of stocks and put it into bonds. Or it's time to have everything in cash, move everything out of bonds and everything in stocks. What does that sound like to me? To me, that sounds like market timing. So I'm not a big fan of these guys, and I would be very, very reticent, which is a fancy word of afraid, of investing any money. But that doesn't mean you might not find one that's good that you want. But I'd say I wouldn't touch these things with a 10-foot pole. Because the times that people think are the best times to invest in stocks, or feel that they're the best times to stop, are usually the absolute worst times to invest. Ooh, is it too late to get in? And the times that you feel are the absolute worst times to invest in stocks are usually the best times to invest in stocks, because there's blood in the streets, and that's the time to invest. Okay, so be careful. You're going to see these guys. Now, the last category, and this is a bit of a review because we already looked at these guys, are money markets. Money market mutual funds, or what people just call money market. You don't usually hear people say money market mutual funds. They just say money markets. And these are the mutual funds that invest in those treasury bills, the things you're looking at. Oh, by the way, it's due on Thursday, right? I forgot to remind you. Thank you for reminding me, Frank. Thursday! And if you're having problems, come see me. Contact me. I get very lonely in my office. Okay, these guys are investing in the treasury bills and the government securities and the tax-exempt muni bonds that are about ready to retire. And they are essentially as safe as guaranteed money market accounts at a bank or a credit union, but they are not guaranteed. Did we already mention that? Did we already mention breaking the buck? We discussed that, didn't we? If they lose a penny, and it happens every 20 years or so, the whole world jumps up and down and screams and hollers and says, yeah! So check these guys out. And they'll have high turnover rates. Why? Because they're investing in stuff that's going to retire, mature in 30 days or 90 days or 100 days, 60 days. So this is where you need the money in 6 months, a year. You don't want to lose the money. A place to park your money. Cool? Thoughts? Now, you now know well, not really. But you've seen the major categories. And what you're going to do is when you start researching, you're going to see that there are even subcategories and subcategories. It gets very complicated. But make sure you know these. Okay? Make sure you understand these, because I'm going to ask you on the exam. But more importantly, you will be able to then ascertain, oh, that's a type of growth and income fund, or that's a type of junk bond fund or whatever. Cool? So now, remember the buffet? This is what you're going to see. These are the people you have to help, because remember, you're the investment guru. You're at that 401k meeting, and Mr. Cool Investor, who thinks he knows what he's doing, is looking at the list of mutual funds, and he sees an aggressive growth fund. And he sees that it's done 13% over 15 years or whatever, and he says, that's what I'm putting my money. I'm going to put all my money in that. Is that a good idea? No, it's a horrible idea. Unless that gentleman has enough steel when that thing goes down 30, 40, 50, 60% to put more in. But what typically happens, and you see it over and over again, and it happens here on the campus, and some of these people have PhD next to their name. The market tanks. What do? They take the money in the aggressive growth fund, and someone told them that if they don't want to lose any money, put it in the stable money market fund. Just in time for the market to, blood in the streets, rebound. And then it goes up 50% or 100%, and what do? They take it out of the market and they put it in the aggressive growth. Who would do that? Who would make stupid mistakes like that? Yeah, a lot of people. A lot of people do it, folks. In fact, we're going to see at the very end of our presentation that the majority of mutual fund investors don't do well as the mutual funds they invest in. How could that be true? I mean, the mutual fund did 8% over 20 years. Why didn't the mutual fund investor do 8%? Because they did this kind of thing. They invested when everybody thinks it's a great time to invest because the market's gone up 100%, right? Do you jump into JCPenney's or Macy's because they raised their prices 100%? Hey, come on in. We just raised our price 100%. And then when prices go on sale, 50, 60%, they jump out. Are you with me? That's why Mr. Buffett says investing is simple, but it ain't easy. Because we not only have to deal with the intellectual part, we have to deal with the emotional part.
And I'll tell you, folks, it ain't easy. And when the market falls, I'm the same way. Everyone says the same thing. It feels like somebody punched you right here or kicked you right in the stomach. It's like, tomorrow is a better day. Women are better. It's already been shown. Women make better investors. It's already been shown statistically. Now, I'll leave it to you to decide why. Okay, cool? Any questions? Any thoughts? So you're going to study this? Stretch, everybody, stretch! Stretch! Because now we're going to look at some other examples of mutual funds that sort of you have to overlay everything we learned about what's going on here. Mutual funds of mutual funds. You knew it had to happen, right? Well, you're kidding, right? No, we're not. And why? These things have become very popular. Why? For various reasons. You, as we said, are going to be most likely working at a company that has a 401k or a 403b or a simple IRA or some other employer-sponsored plan. Chances are, over 90, I don't know the exact number, but chances are you're going to have mutual funds as your investment choice. Some of them have a self-directed portion where you could buy individual stocks and bonds, but most don't. These are the choices, mutual funds. And so when we would, investment advisors, give people a list of mutual funds, they go, I don't know. So which one should I invest in? Oh, you mean I can lose my money? Okay, which one doesn't, when I won't lose my money? The money market? Okay, I'm 23 years old. I'll put everything in the money market. Is that smart? No, that's dumb. This is money you're not going to touch for 40 years if you're 23. You need to be over here. Right? You need to be somewhere over here. And so, but they don't know. They really don't know. And are they supposed to know? Have they taken business 123? No. So you're the guru. You're going to help them. But if you're not there, what the industry has done is said, look, when are you going to retire? I'm going to retire in 2035. Okay, we have a mutual fund for you. Or you're going to retire in 2050. We have a mutual fund for you. And what that mutual fund company will do is they will invest accordingly. If you're not going to retire for 40 years, it'll be mostly over here. And as you get closer and closer to the date that you expect to retire, they're going to move you down the risk versus return spectrum. Does that make sense? And importantly, from the viewpoint of the employer, if you offer these things to your employees, then you can automatically enroll them in the 401k. You can automatically start taking 3 or 5% of their salary or more. I think it's no more than 3 or 5%. And put it into the, because they know how old you are, they know your date, put it into the appropriate retirement date, target date, lifestyle fund, whatever, that's fit for you. And I don't like these things personally. I mean, I like them because they help people invest. But what I don't like about them is that they're just too darn conservative, from my humble opinion. They have people in their 20s in bonds. You don't need bonds in your 20s. It's dumb. But hey, that's their prudent choices. And so if you do that, if you're the employer and you do that, then the employee cannot sue you for making a bad recommendation. As soon as you make a recommendation, first of all, you're supposed to be licensed. As soon as you make a recommendation, you need to have insurance. Errors and omissions insurance, in case what you did, what you recommended, was bad. And if they sue you, it's up to you to show them. They got to sue you. They got to pay their lawyers. The lawyers win. But you have to show them the why. No, this was a prudent choice for you, for your appropriate situation. And if you're the employer and you put them in these funds, then can't get sued, which is a cool thing, right? We don't like to be sued, do we? No, only the lawyers win in this case. Any lawyer jokes? No lawyer. What do you know when you see three lawyers buried up to their necks in concrete? What do you know? No, they ran out of concrete. Couldn't bury them all. Okay. Anyway. Okay. So, any questions? Any thoughts? Now you're going to study hard. Yes. Because remember, you're the investment guru for your friends and family and coworkers, and this is a very weighty, important responsibility. Okay, on Thursday we should finish up mutual funds. We may not. We should finish up mutual funds, and we'll take a look at mutual fund families, and then we'll concentrate on a single mutual fund. We'll take a look at a sample mutual fund. Cool. See you on Thursday, everyone. Be awesome, dear students.